Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Hello and welcome to ID the Future. I'm Jay Richards with the Center for Science and Culture at the Discovery Institute here in Seattle. Today joining us is Benjamin Weicker to talk about his new book, 10 Books Every Conservative Must Read. Many of you probably know Ben Weicker. He was a co-author of the book A Meaningful World a few years back with Jonathan Witt. It's a highly recommended book on evidence of beauty, design, and purpose in nature. Weicker received his PhD from Vanderbilt University, and he's taught at Marquette University, St. Mary's University, Thomas Aquinas College, and Franciscan University. He's now a full-time writer, though, and he's a senior fellow here at the Discovery Institute and also at the St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology. He's an author of a number of books, and in fact, he had a book prior to this one called 10 Books That Screwed Up the World, which is this is in some ways, I suppose, a sequel of, but we're going to just talk to Ben for a few minutes about his current book, 10 Books Every Conservative Must Read. Ben, welcome to the show.
And thanks for having me.
Well, this is a delightful book. I've been enjoying it over the last couple of weeks. And my wife always tells me, okay, if you read a book that you really think I have to read, tell me. And so this is one of the books that I told her, okay, this is really the next book you have to read. Because I read a lot of kind of boring stuff that, you know, most normal people wouldn't be interested in.
But let alone wives.
Yeah, exactly. Let alone my wife, who has better things to do than read, you know, dreadful books. But this one is just terrific. And it's in some ways, it's a summary of books that, frankly, as you said, every conservative must read, or that you would hope every sort of thinking person, traditionalist, would get around to reading these. But the reality is, you know, unless you're someone like you or like me that's, you know, studied philosophy and done graduate school, you're just not going to necessarily get around to reading all these. Well, the books you treat, I'll just mention them briefly, and then I'll ask you a couple of things. But you start with Aristotle's Politics, and then you go to G.K. Chesterton's great book, Orthodoxy, Eric Voegelin's The New Science of Politics, which I'm guessing, you know, a lot of people have not read, the classic by C.S. Lewis, The Abolition of Man, which, as it happens, was a book that turned me around in my thinking in college. Then the great Irish statesman Edmund Burke's book, Reflections on the Revolution in France, Alexis de Tocqueville's Democracy in America, the great Federalist Papers, but then you also have a chapter on the Anti-Federalists, which you argue, I think correctly, is perhaps more guidance to us today than the Federalist Papers. Then the economics books you have are The Servile State by Hilaire Belloc and The Road to Serfdom, which many people have heard of, by great Austrian economist Hayek. So that's your top 10, and you have some leftovers, I suppose, because it's hard to reduce these things to 10, but the four that people shouldn't miss is The Tempest by Shakespeare, Sense and Sensibility by Austen, The Lord of the Rings by Tolkien, The Jerusalem Bible by God and many translators, I suppose, as the author. And then One Imposter, which I was really interested in, which is Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand.
I'll get eyebrows lifted on that one.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, I really, what struck me in reading through the book, though, was the recurring themes that you have. But, you know, there are really a couple preliminary things I think we ought to talk about. I mean, the first is, why did you feel like writing this book?
Well, it was a follow-up to 10 Books That Screwed Up the World, because obviously those were the books that had caused the most destruction over the last 500 years and still are causing problems. But the one thing that I always got asked at the end of the interviews was, okay, that's well done, and we understand how destructive these were, but what do we read that could help? We need good books that could bring us back. And so that was the impetus to get going in a book that would give us those profound thinkers that could carry us forward at these particularly not too helpful and somewhat destructive times.
Well, you know, you're exactly right. I mean, that's what's funny is that, I mean, we're starting with a 4th century Greek philosopher named Aristotle in Politics, but it's amazing the insights that he has for our contemporary situation. I mean, you know, the books you described, most were written in the last, you know, 3 centuries or 4 centuries, I suppose, except, of course, for Aristotle, which reaches a long ways back. But I noted that none of these books have been written, let's see, in the last 50 years, I suppose. You know, perhaps the most recent would be something by Lewis or Tolkien. But, you know, the insights that you distill from these, you know, they are obviously germane to our current debate.
And I did try to make them that way throughout the whole thing. And I wanted to detach conservatives from the bestseller list.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's often not the best place to go for the deepest wisdom.
No, and you know, every political movement has its intellectuals and it has its populace, and you know, you sort of need both of those, of course, in a democracy. But this is where you go to get the meat rather than just the milk. You know, I'm wondering, talk a little bit about the difficulty of speaking of quote conservatism and liberalism with the changing meanings of these words. How do you handle that?
Well, it is difficult because there is so much confusion. Part of the problem is that we in America have a much different perspective than Europeans. In Europe, the term conservative means, means to most of them, those who want the old order back, where kings and the aristocracy ruled society. And so that's what it would mean for them to be a conservative. For the term liberal was coined more or less in the 19th century to describe those who were rejecting the notion that entrenched aristocracy had to rule society, mm-hmm. but were holding to what we would describe as conservative principles. Now, liberal over here means something entirely different. It means more like a secular view that wants to overturn traditional morality and has roots in a lot of the secularist ideologies of the 19th and 20th century. So it has a much different meaning when you say liberal, and that can get confusing because many of the people in this book would identify themselves as liberals, but they're speaking as a European.
That's right. So you, Chesterton, for instance, and Edmund Burke, you cite as examples. And that, it looks paradoxical. It's not so much paradoxical as that these words just mean different things. So that, you know, the American conservatives more frequently than not are defending things like limited government and traditional moral values and, reasonably free economic system. Those things that were identified with a part of the sort of best threads of so-called classical liberalism, but now in the American context end up being identified with conservatism. So, I appreciated you dealing with that because this is something that, leads to no end of confusion. What I really noticed in the thread through these books, because of course if somebody looks at it, it looks like it's a book just about politics, but it's, of course, about politics. It's about our public life, about the sort of social manifestation of human nature. But it's also about metaphysics and philosophy and theology. And I noticed how many of the books, especially, Orthodoxy by Chesterton, The New Science of Politics by Vogelin, and The Abolition of Man, in particular, by C.S. Lewis, you talked about the role of materialism and how significant that is. Describe for listeners, why is materialism important when you're writing and talking about politics?
Well, let me approach it from G.K. Chesterton's angle. For him, materialism was a shrinking of a reality. It wasn't an expansion as secularists tend to portray it. We're materialists now, we're scientific, we're rational, we're leaving all these old things behind as superstitions. Chesterton rightly saw it as the reverse. Materialists were pre-defining reality to include only certain things and eliminating all the aspects of our everyday experience, which we know are real, as not real, simply defining them out of existence. So you have daily in your life the experience that you're more than simply some kind of a chemical reaction, a set of chain reactions in a body. Mm-hmm. You make choices, you think about things, you decide whether you're going to eat this or that. So even though you have a body, you act as if you're not reducible to a body. You treat love as something that's real, emanating from the core of your being, not something that is a chemical reaction in your sexual organs. So for Chesterton, this fundamental beginning point is the full complexity of reality as we experience it, not this shrunken, constricted view that comes from materialism. And when materialism becomes the foundation of politics, it leads to treating human beings as if they are indeed sort of coagulations of chemicals that can be pushed and shoved into whatever form the powers that be desire. So it leads to a kind of a tyranny based on a pseudoscience. And what Chesterton and others, as Eric Voegelin, were trying to do is recall this, what they call the pre-scientific, normal, everyday, common sense view of the full complexity of human beings, and that should be the foundation of our political life.
It's in many ways a much more dignified view of the ordinary person. Everyone Absolutely. Knows you directly experience that there are other persons, that there's a world out there, that there are these fundamental moral intuitions that everyone knows is true. No matter, even, you know, 5 seconds after you get out of your philosophy class, you immediately get morally indignant, you know, if somebody steals your car, even if you've learned that, you know, there's no transcendent morality. These kinds of things that are, it's ultimately the best foundation for preserving the dignity of ordinary individual human beings, which, you know, most American liberals imagine themselves as the champions of that, but they've undercut the foundations on which that basic moral intuition can be grounded.
You know, yeah, absolutely.
In the treatment of the abolition of man by C.S. Lewis, that book was really important to me. I went to a very liberal, secularized liberal arts college as an undergrad, and of course had a freshman seminar course that the purpose of it was essentially to teach sort of moral and ontological relativism. And I stumbled on Lewis's book somebody had given me, and it's really profound because in some ways people can think it's sort of overblown. And I think, you know, when it was written, it seems quite extreme, some of the things he said, but it's in many ways prophetic. And there's
it's really a book of prophecy. One of the shortest, most profound books I think I've ever read. It says more in its few pages than most books say in 300 to 400. But as you say, it focuses on this fundamental truth that we live in a time in which moral argument has been replaced by simply technological manipulation. We don't assume that human nature is already defined, and so we don't assume that there are limits which define how we can act morally and what we should do. And Lewis's warning was, once you start manipulating human nature without any notion of moral guidance, then you will have abolished human nature by technical power. And that means giving power to those few people who are doing the manipulating, in which, as again Lewis prophetically saw, would be a kind of a union of political and technical power of those who had some grand vision of how they wanted to remake human nature in their own image. So it is a terrifying book, but it's terrifyingly true. That's what we are seeing now, and the 20th century was full of it.
It was. And, you know, I mean, he wrote this, of course, you know, some 50 years ago or more, but you've got this terrific quote in the book that I just want to read. It says, the final stage, that is the final stage of this sort of totalitarian vision, which combines technical expertise with a fundamentally materialistic and relativistic worldview. Lewis says, the final stage has come when man, by eugenics, by prenatal conditioning, and by an education and propaganda based on a perfect applied psychology, has obtained full control over himself. Human nature will be the last part of nature to surrender to man. The battle will indeed be won. Now, you know, I am one of these people that's read books by Ray Kurzweil and so-called transhumanists who, you know, are assuming here in 15 or 20 years we're going to upload our earthly bodies to, you know, to more robust hardware. We're going to all become a part of the internet and, you know, replace our brains. And I mean, these are, you know, they're serious people talking this way. And yet C.S. Lewis anticipated this in the middle of the 20th century. It's really quite striking.
It is. And it goes, you know, I point to examples of this occurring in relationship to reproductive technology. You know, this is the remaking of human nature right under our very eyes. And it's done with no notion that you could be violating something that's sacred. Why? Well, one of the premises of this notion is that there is nothing sacred. Otherwise, you wouldn't be manipulating all the limits. And so, again, one of the most chilling aspects of Lewis' argument is we used to have arguments between those who were had a conservative understanding of reality and those who were liberal in I would say today's sense, in being a moral relativist. But those were arguments of words. Now they're arguments of technical power, where one side says you can't do that, and the other side says, no, we really can, just watch.
Yeah, it's just absolutely staggering. Now, you know, I'd love to talk about this in detail, but for anyone interested in these subjects, there's just, you know, no better thing you can do than go on Amazon and get a copy of Ben's book. But I do, Ben, want to ask you one question about your chapter 15, because, of course, among, you know, people that generally think of themselves as conservatives in the United States, there are fissures, at least kind of philosophical fissures, in which, you know, people end up really disagreeing on some fundamental issues. And I found this to be the case, especially with Ayn Rand. Many people who, religious people, you know, maybe conservative Christians or Jews otherwise, nevertheless think Rand is a terrific intellectual resource for defending the free economy and the free society. Now, you say some good things about Rand. It's not a sort of one-sided critique, but you argue ultimately that, you know, she's sort of an imposter as a conservative and, in fact, is an anti-conservative. Why do you argue that?
Well, first of all, again, she couldn't be an imposter if she didn't resemble conservatism in some way. And so I do draw out of her, here are the good points, and I think I've drawn out some that many conservatives have missed. In some ways, she has some more profound things that haven't been picked up that go far beyond just merely the economy.
Right.
But that having been said, there are really dark aspects of Rand that cannot be ignored or treated as incidental, because she certainly didn't treat them as incidental. And by the way, people should know that she rejected conservatism and liberalism, mm-hmm. And she hated Ronald Reagan. She hated Friedrich Hayek.
Yep.
And she hated libertarians. She hated everybody.
That's right, including a lot of
her own
cohorts. Yeah.
Yeah, and you got to be careful. You know, obviously something is up there. And as I argue in the book, somebody like Friedrich Hayek is a much better guide to deep understanding of economics than Ayn Rand is. Now, Ayn Rand is very attractive because, you know, she's got that literary flair.
Yeah.
But I make clear in this chapter, here are the dark parts of her argument, mm-hmm. and they're illustrated in her own life that show you what it really means to live according to the philosophy of Ayn Rand. And it's not pretty.
No.
I challenge anyone who affirms Rand to read the recent biographers of her life, because right. it is really almost sickening what it really means to live by the virtue of selfishness. And she did it and destroyed her own family, her own marriage, and turned her own disciples into really almost psychotic cases. that's what it really means. So we want to not mistake what we think she's saying for what she really means.
Mm.
And there's much better people to rescue us from things like moral relativism and from socialism than Ayn Rand. That having been said, again, I do point out, here are some good things.
Sure.
Don't miss those. We just can't pick and choose, because she saw herself as, you know, she saw her dark parts as being light, and that's a problem.
It is. A lot of people may not realize one of the last speeches that Rand ever gave was an attack on George Gilder, who was a co-founder of the Discovery Institute, because he was arguing that, in fact, it's not just simple selfishness and greed that animates the great entrepreneurs, but it's what he called altruism. He meant that in a specific sense, that a person that's a good entrepreneur is other-regarding. They think about the needs and desires of others. They anticipate things that people would want, and that's something far beyond, you know, mere selfishness or greed. And it's funny because, of course, Gilder's work was the thing that went to be quoted prominently during the years of the Reagan presidency. It wasn't Rand. And so, as you say, there are just a lot of much better resources for conservatives. Well, Ben, this is a terrific book. I really appreciate you working on it. I know you toiled away at this, and it's staggering, because I know you've had quite an output as an author here in the last few years. But I just highly recommend 10 Books Every Conservative Must Read by Ben Weicker. Ben, thanks for joining us.
And thanks for having me.
For ID the Future, I'm Jay Richards with the Center for Science and Culture at Discovery Institute in Seattle. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2010. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.